Welcome to Enabled, the weekly program about people just like you who are dealing with issues of vision loss. The program is designed to encourage you through news you can use, inspirational stories, and interviews. I'm Nancy Zimmer, your host for Enabled. Thank you for joining me. Today I will present a difficult topic. It's difficult to think about and difficult to talk about: violence against people who are blind. First, I will share two personal stories with you, and then I have information about self-defense and background information about domestic violence. All the information in this program came from the Vision Aware website. To start out with, the headline reads, Domestic Violence Has Many Faces. And once again, this is from visionaware.org. The story was written by Linda Fugit, and she's a doctor of education. She's a certified vision rehabilitation therapist, and she is an advisor at Vision Aware Peer Program. She is writing the story of her experience. She says, domestic violence has many faces, many victims, and many stories. This is just one of them, but it is mine. First, a little background. She says, I was raised in the 1950s by a single mother, and there were no older male relatives in my life. Also, I was diagnosed with a visual impairment at the age of 15, caused by a rare disorder. My reaction to being told that my dreams would never be possible was the birth of my daughter a year later. I married in the 1970s and settled down to raise a family. The story is typical at its beginning. My sheltered childhood did not prepare me to discern typical of abusive behaviors. I also was unaware of the effects of alcohol, as no one in my family ever drank. First, there was the breaking down of my self-esteem. He would ask me to read something that he knew I couldn't see, or find fault with the house, and then comment about my abilities, or rather my lack of them. This also helped to increase the isolation from others, especially in a new location where I did not recognize voices. And finally, the beginning of violent outbursts. The first time this happened, I left. He begged, promising it would never happen again, and I returned. As the violence escalated, I realized that my vision was being used against me. He would approach, trying for my blind spot. As it increased, I quickly learned to hide this from him, but the fear was always there. He learned that turning the lights on or off made it difficult for me to see, and he used that to gain an advantage and increase my fear. He would find me before my eyes adjusted to the change. As my vision loss made daily life more complicated, the fear and abuse made it overwhelming. This was before abuse was acknowledged and support groups were formed. And with no male relative to protect me, family members looked the other way, and friends became busy. This was still the era when the common idea was that an abused wife was somehow at fault, and in my case, my vision was to blame. And I believed it. I tried to change to overcome the vision loss. It is probably an important fact that at this point, I had no training related to my vision loss. The turning point came when the abuse was aimed at one of my children. That was not to be tolerated. Although I had felt unable to help myself, protecting my child gave me the courage to take a stand. Even after I left, the fear was still there, and for good reason. One night when I was returning home, he stepped out of the shadows, grabbed me, and broke my arm. I never saw him until it was too late. I did not file a report for a couple of reasons. First, at that time, he would have been back on the street before I was out of the emergency room. Second, and no one could know that I did not see him. That was far more dangerous. He had taught me to trust no one, and so I was afraid to allow the extent of my vision loss to be known by anyone. I struggled to avoid situations that I found dangerous, and that could include something as simple as someone standing in the wrong spot. It has been over 30 years now, and I am still more comfortable with a wall on my left side. My children are grown, but even though some of them were still quite young at the end of that long dark night, each has told me stories of the fear and the panic that they felt. After that, I did learn to protect myself. I learned about my vision and how to use it more efficiently. This restored my confidence. It helped me to see that I was still a capable person, someone who had value. That is something often lost in abuse. Times have changed. Now we have an awareness of domestic violence and abuse. Now we have support groups and shelters. Now we have advocates. We have classes to teach us how to protect ourselves. And we still have domestic violence and abuse. As someone who has been there, been in the depths of fear, of pain, and of isolation, I know when you are there, the way out is often invisible, even if you can see. This was written by Linda Fugit, an employee of visionaware.org. And next, we have another personal story from the same website. The headline is called Violent Crime Against People Who Are Blind, My Personal Story. This was written by Linda Jones, who is also a certified vision rehabilitation trainer and a Vision Aware peer advisor. She starts out with a quote, "An alert mind is the necessary catalyst that is needed for protecting yourself, reminding yourself that you are not invincible, and trusting your instincts are the first steps in the right direction." This comes from a source called RAD Systems of Self-Defense. I'll tell you more about that. "If I had heeded these words," she says, the words that were found in the RAD training manual. This is the RAD stands for Rape Aggression Defense. The RAD training manual created by Lawrence NATO. "I might not have to be telling this story, or this story might have a different ending." Early one summer afternoon in 1988, during an internship at a rehabilitation agency for people with visual impairments, I left the agency around 1 p.m. and started walking home. It was an extremely hot afternoon. I was so glad my apartment was only two long blocks with a short jog to the left in between. I put the shoulder strap of my purse over my head and tucked my teaching notebook between my arm and my purse, believing that I had my purse well protected. Even though the neighborhood did not have sidewalks, walking along the edge of the streets was not dangerous because there was rarely any traffic. I reached the end of the first block and started to cross when a jogger ran by on the opposite side of the street. It was so hot. Why would anybody be jogging at this time of day? I crossed the street, turned left, and walked the 60 feet or so to my next corner. By the time I reached that corner, the jogger had already crossed the street. I turned right and started walking along the right side of the street. Immediately, I noticed the street had been graveled. At the same time, I heard the jogger turn around and start back. He doesn't seem to know where he wants to go, I thought. In a matter of moments, I heard the jogger coming up on my right side. My first thought was perhaps I was not walking along the edge of the street. Never once did I feel endangered. Then suddenly he was only inches from my face. In one movement, he cut the strap of my purse with his right hand, pulled it from under my arm with his left. As he ran away, I turned and yelled at him. Next, I heard the voices of an older man and his son who had seen the attack through their living room window. They came running to see if I was all right while the older man's wife called the police. It wasn't long before the police arrived, but when they saw I wasn't injured, there wasn't much they could do. They said the perpetrator probably would throw away my purse after he took my money. I was almost to my apartment complex, so I walked home, thankful that I had always carried my house keys on my cane. Because my husband was working out of town, I called my college advisor and told her about the robbery. She came right over. I told her I felt all right. I wasn't afraid to stay alone that night. However, the next morning, when it was time to walk to the agency to teach, I was afraid to leave my apartment. Never in my life had I felt blind. Now I felt vulnerable and paranoid. I was afraid to do my laundry. What if the attacker was hiding in the laundry room? What if he lived in my neighborhood? For several days, I had to ride to the agency with an employee, a fellow employee. When my husband returned, he drove me. But finally, one day, I made up my mind. I would not allow the attacker to steal my freedom and my independence. Perhaps I could have prevented the robbery if I hadn't rationalized the attacker's every move. Perhaps if I'd turned and yelled, "Quit following me," or "Get away from me," it would have discouraged the attacker. This experience taught me not only to be consistently aware of what is happening around me, but to allow my instincts to warn me when other people's behaviors don't seem normal. Several years later, while teaching a summer program for visually impaired teenagers through Florida State University, the FSU Police Department agreed to conduct RAD training, and once again, this is Rape Aggression Defense, RAD training program for girls. It was the first time the RAD program had been taught to visually impaired individuals. Through RAD, the girls learned techniques to protect themselves from attackers. The officers did hands-on for those of us who had no usable vision. They asked us to feel the positions of their arms, legs, their feet, and also to move our body parts in position when necessary. We practiced with the male officers. We used the techniques that did not require seeing what the perpetrator was doing. Some moves require seeing the perpetrator coming at you. For example, I did not try to remember all of the moves, just a few, so they would become automatic if I ever felt threatened in a real-life situation. At the end of the training, the girls practiced what they had learned against the male FSU police officers. It was my hope at that time that those girls would never experience what I had experienced. The RAD Systems of Self-Defense, this is the name of the program, the RAD Systems of Self-Defense. The mission of the RAD Systems is to establish an accessible, constantly improving, and internationally respected alliance of dedicated instructors. These instructors provide educational opportunities for women, children, men, and seniors. This is in order to create a safer future for themselves. In doing this, they challenge society to evolve into an existence where violence is not an acceptable part of daily life. If you're interested in this training program, a website is www.rad-systems.com. It's a self-defense training resource. Now, another article is called Sightless Self-Defense. This can help you stay safe. This was written by Audrey Demet, who's a registered nurse, and she's also a Vision Aware peer advisor. She says, last summer I took an introductory workshop on self-defense at Hull Park and Retreat Center, located east of Portland, Oregon. It was my first exposure to anything related to martial arts and the idea that I can protect myself by using learned techniques. While I have never been attacked, I would like to learn how to prevent and handle any such event. As a woman who is visually impaired and travels alone, it seemed prudent to educate myself on personal safety and self-defense practices. Next, we go to a part of the program called Meet Sensei Stan Miller. Sensei Stan Miller. Now, an explanation about that term, sensei. This is a term of honor which you use when referring to a martial arts teacher. Instead of saying Mr. Miller or Teacher Miller, you would say Sensei Miller. Sensei Miller was the instructor that day. He is the founder of what's called Portland Small Circle Jiu-Jitsu. He has been teaching martial arts since 1983. He holds black belt rank with Jiu-Jitsu of America and Professor Wally J's Small Circle Jiu-Jitsu, and has trained in many other disciplines as well. Sensei Miller currently holds a level of fifth degree black belt master instructor. He has also instructed police and military personnel. I'm sure you're wondering, what is jiu-jitsu? Jiu-jitsu is a martial art that was practiced by the Japanese samurai warriors. It is an ancient method of hand-to-hand combat, combining a variety of techniques such as joint locking, judo throws, strike combinations, and pressure points to defend oneself when weapons are not available. Jiu-jitsu techniques are often taught in self-defense classes for women because it is possible to neutralize an attacker quickly and then escape. The program called Small Circle Jiu-Jitsu is a refined system of efficient and effective self-defense used in close quarters. It focuses on joint manipulation to control an opponent with maximum results through minimum effort. Jiu-jitsu is the mother of many martial arts taught today. The creation of what's called sightless self-defense. In 1996, Sensei Miller developed a program called Sightless Self-Defense. This is specifically designed for people who are blind or visually impaired. This system is a unique blend of his martial arts training and adapted techniques. He has taught sightless self-defense classes through the Oregon Commission for the Blind for over 25 years. Michael Yamada, a certified orientation and mobility instructor with a background in judo, teaches the classes along with Sensei Miller. They incorporate mobility instruction and travel safety into this training. A quote, his expertise, referring to Michael Yamada, his assistant, his expertise in safe mobility has enhanced our classes, remarks Sensei Miller. This adapted system can be learned by students of all ages and abilities. Some basic principles of sightless self-defense now for you. This training begins with lessons in a few basic principles rooted in jiu-jitsu. Balance and stability are fundamental principles taught in the class. Here's a quote. We start with an open, relaxed posture and then teach a closed, strong stance with short, controlled steps to maintain balance and improve stability and mobility, explains Sensei Miller. Breathing techniques are taught to enable the student to stay calm and focused. Decision making is also an important principle. Sensei Miller says staying calm with proper breathing will help improve your decision making skills. Students learn how to respond if someone makes physical contact with them. This concept is called contact response and was developed by Sensei Miller. The contact may be a bump, a hard grab, or hand on the shoulder. A quick and loud verbal response is the first step in self-protection. We learn to say, back off! And practiced this verbal response in the workshop I attended. Students learn to turn toward the person and establish a strong posture and stance. They use proper breathing to stay calm and determine the level of the threat. As Sensei Miller points out, it could be a friend or foe. You don't want to palm strike Aunt Susie in the face. Another adaptive concept developed by Sensei Miller is called touch sight. Touch sight refers to the mental image you create of your opponent's physical abilities, location, and intentions. The information exists as long as contact is maintained. The student uses this information to position themselves to improve balance, maintain contact, and locate the vital points on the opponent's body. Without contact, the lack of information places a person who is blind in chaos. With no information about the attacker, where he is, what he has, what he is doing, from where he is coming, the person who is blind is extremely vulnerable with no information. All these things are known by locking onto the attacker and using touch sight. Next section is called the Safe for Life program. The classes are not just about fighting skills. Sensei Miller takes a broader whole life approach to sightless self-defense and personal safety. He reports the class has evolved into the Safe for Life program, teaching students to be aware of all kinds of threats and intrusions into their lives, including intrusions from cyberspace and other scams. I quote, our philosophy for this program is to give the individual basic knowledge of what is possible for them in a crisis situation. I want them to feel empowered by what they can do mentally, verbally, and physically. We want to give them some tools and the confidence to live a safe and secure life, explains Sensei Miller. He believes people need to be in control of their personal safety, and self-defense training enables them to do just that. To finish up this article, they give you several helpful tips on personal safety from Sensei Miller. First of all, take the time to secure your home. Leave lights on and lock all doors and windows. Make sure smoke detectors are working. identify who is at your door before opening it. Number two, take time to secure yourself on the street. Be alert and aware of your surroundings. Walk with your head up and walk with purpose. Secure your wallet, backpack, or purse. Organize your money and cards so that you can access them and put them away quickly. Number three, let someone know your travel plans. Give family or friends details about where you are going, the route you're taking, and when you plan to return. And the fourth idea from Sensei Miller, be careful about the personal information you share on social media, or I will add personal information you share anywhere. Be careful about that. More information can be found at www.portlandjujitsu.com. And that jujitsu part is spelled J-U-J-I-T-S-U, portlandjujitsu.com. And you can contact Sensei Miller himself by email, samuraimiller@hotmail.com. And a disclaimer here, a little reminder, talk to your medical doctor and eye doctor before participating in any self-defense programs. Yes, I said talk to your eye doctor. Some eye and medical conditions can be affected by athletic activity that includes bending, lifting, straining, or pulling. This is before you can take part in one of these training programs. The next article starts with a section called Domestic Violence and Women with Disabilities, including women with vision loss. This is written by a lawyer, Leslie Malcolm, who's from the New Jersey Coalition to End Domestic Violence. She starts out with two examples. Every day when John left for work, he locked Marie's wheelchair in a closet, took the internet router with him, and the portable phone. Marie had trouble moving about the house, couldn't reach out for help, and definitely could not leave. Another example, Larry keeps charge of Joan's medications for anxiety, depression, and chronic pain. He gives Joan far less than is actually prescribed, so she lives in constant pain and fear. But Joan relies on Larry for all of her daily care, and she is afraid to tell anyone about her not getting the medications. We have a definition now of domestic violence, a very important one. Many people are confused about what domestic violence is, what causes it, and why women would stay in the abusive relationship. Domestic violence is a pattern of intimidation, coercion, and violence. It includes everything the abuser has done in the past and the threat of what he'll do in the future. The entire goal of domestic violence is to obtain and maintain power and control over the victim. The pattern of abuse often increases in frequency and severity over time. This part is important. The battering, this domestic violence, can be verbal. It can be physical, which you probably know about. I started out with verbal. It can be physical. It can be emotional abuse. It can be sexual abuse or economic abuse. Any of that classifies as domestic abuse. An abused person can be of any age, race, class, culture, religion, occupation, or sexual orientation. And to clarify, sexual assault, this can be part of domestic violence, or it can occur entirely by itself. Sexual assault is any type of sexual contact or behavior that occurs without the explicit consent of the recipient. It can include sexual activities such as forced sexual intercourse, forcible sodomy, child molestation, incest, fondling, and attempted rape. Also, a definition of stalking behaviors. Stalking behaviors are often considered part of domestic violence. While legal definitions of stalking vary from one jurisdiction to another, the basic definition of stalking is a course of conduct directed at a specific person that would cause any reasonable person to feel fear. Stalking is serious, often violent, and can escalate over time. Next section, women with disabilities are more vulnerable to domestic violence. Research indicates that women with disabilities are more likely to suffer domestic violence and sexual assault than women without disabilities. And women with disabilities report that the abuse lasts longer and is more intense than women without disabilities. Like other women, women with disabilities usually are abused by someone they know, such as a partner or a family member. In addition, women with disabilities face the risk of abuse by healthcare providers or caregivers. Caregivers can withhold medicine and assistive devices, such as wheelchairs or braces. They can also refuse to help with the daily needs like bathing, dressing, or eating. Next, you've got to know domestic violence is never the fault of the victim. Domestic and sexual assault, stalking, and neglect are never the fault of the victim. They are not based on stress, drugs, or alcohol. They are due to the active choice of the abuser to use violence or other intimidating tactics to control his victim. And repeating, domestic violence is never the fault of the victim. Victims stay with their abuser for many reasons, including economic, cultural, and fear of losing custody of the children. Perhaps most important, victims fear increased violence or death if they leave. In fact, the most dangerous time for a victim is when she is trying to leave. This may be due to the abuser feeling like he is losing control over his victim. For women with disabilities, it can be even worse. If they are being abused by someone they rely on to take care of them, they may feel trapped. Women who are blind or visually impaired have additional concerns related to their vision. As one victim noted, "I realized that my vision was being used against me. And I learned about my vision later and how to use it more efficiently, and this restored my confidence." So we have, first of all, a contact information. Help is available. If possible, you can reach out for help from someone trusted. They recommend someone like a doctor, a family member, a friend, a neighbor, or a member of the clergy. Reach out for help. Help is also available from national and state domestic and sexual violence organizations. The National Domestic Violence Hotline is 1-800-799, and then you spell out the word SAFE, which is equal in numbers to 7233. But actually, you know, I got to thinking, if you're in an abusive situation, you're not going to want to have that phone number sitting around on an end table somewhere in case you need it. I found from the Rochester, where this program originates, the Rochester Police Department website, a very good advice. If you are being threatened or if you are in immediate danger, call 911. That's a simple solution. Call 911. The responders know how to handle situations like this, and you can have confidence that the system will take over and give you some help if you need it. So the quote to think about to end this program today comes back from the content of the program, something you should never forget. Domestic violence is never the fault of the victim. Well, thank you for listening, and I hope if you need help, you will seek help and you will get help. You've been listening to Enabled, a production of WXXI Reach Out Radio in Rochester, New York. Our technical director is Maureen Rich, and I'm Nancy Zimmer. I hope you'll join me again next week for more updates and information and encouraging stories. If you'd like to hear this program again, you can listen to it at our website, wxxi.org.